Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. We're on episode 8, and I'm Andy Walsh, and joined as always by my wife, Jody.
Hi.
How are we doing, Jody?
Still in quarantine, still waiting for coronavirus to let us out. Yep, so I guess we thought we would talk a little bit about how the science is getting done. I've seen a lot of interesting posts online this past week about, we don't need to go into details of all of that, but there have been some questionable content online, and there's a lot of questions about how science actually gets done, how labs are funded. There are all kinds of comments that people make about big pharma making all kinds of money off of, drugs and vaccines. And there's just not a very clear understanding of, who pays for all the science, who does all the science, who reaps the benefits of all the science. So how about we start our discussion there?
Sure. So it's one thing to talk about how science gets done in terms of the scientific method and laboratory experiments or field work or those kinds of things. But there's also a big part of how science gets done in terms of where does the money come from and what do you do once you've done your experiments. So we talked a little bit before about research funding. In the United States, the single largest source of funding is the National Institutes of Health, or the NIH. That is where Dr. Anthony Fauci works. He's been in the news a lot. So he works for the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is one of the institutes of health that's part of the National Institutes of Health. There are a number of other institutes that deal with different kinds of healthcare concerns, mental health, chronic diseases, all these different things. And they're overseen by somebody named Francis Collins, is the director of the overall institution. And they have the, in terms of the federal budget, they have the largest research funds to go around.
So this is an institution, but it's not really like, it doesn't change depending on who the president is. Like they're separate from the government. Like, I guess one of the questions, where does the Surgeon General fit in?
Okay, so that's an interesting question. The Surgeon General is the head of the Public Health Service, which is a separate thing. And it has links or history associated with the military, which is why the Surgeon General is called a Surgeon General and wears a military uniform. There's actually a whole separate Public Health Service. And those folks have a uniform that they can wear. It's not exactly a branch of the military, but it has a connection to the military. And that is a separate function. The NIH, and that is more focused on the operation of public health and public health recommendations and things like that. So the Surgeon General is the one who decides about warnings on cigarettes and things like that. That has more to do with applying research that has been done. The National Institutes of Health is more about doing the research, both basic science research. How do cells work? How do different genes, what do different genes do? Things like questions like that, as well as more applied research, like how do we develop drugs and vaccines and clinical things like that. And so the NIH has its own research facilities. There are some people who are scientists who work for the NIH at the different institutes to do actual research in facilities run there and with funding provided by that institution. There are hospitals that are run, you know, so they conduct some clinical trials themselves. And so they have their own medical facilities where they do all of that and oversee patients and so forth. And so there are physicians who work for the National Institutes of Health. And then they also provide a lot of funding for science to be done at other places, at both academic institutions and businesses. So there are two, if you ever look at the NIH's grant offerings, they kind of get split into two channels or two directions. There are grants that are specifically intended for academic university research, and there are grants that are specifically intended for small businesses. And so they're funding, you know, that funding, and they're done through grants. And there are scientists, so in addition to the scientists who work for the NIH, there are scientists who work in these other places who come together and sit on grant committees and decide what grants to offer, right? So it's not that you can't just wake up one morning and decide, I would like to do this scientific research project. Please, dear NIH, please send me $3 million. Sincerely, Dr. Andy Walsh. Thank you. You have to wait for them to decide what they want, what they think needs to be researched. And that's impacted by the scientists who are part of these committees. It's impacted by previous research that they funded. They want to, they want to continue developing things that they've already invested in that have shown promise. And so, you know, in one round of funding, they might, you know, fund a research project on, you know, drug discovery. And then if a drug shows promise, then the next round will be, you know, things for developing that towards clinical trials and so forth.
So just, you know, thinking about this, you go into science, you become a scientist, you need to find funding, so you need to write grants. And so there are a group of scientists who are deciding what promise is in your idea, what value is there, and so they fund based on that. So I guess I want to... One of the things that I think one of the misunderstandings we often find within media coverage, within just general conversations, you always hear whenever it's like an election year or something like that, you always hear this general criticism of, you know, these scientists are doing these stupid, nonsensical, you know, research, you know, and so they pull out like the most bizarre topics. But there is, you know, it could sound really bizarre, but there could be actual value in what they're studying.
Yeah, so we maybe gotten a little too narrow focused on the NIH and not addressing some of the bigger questions. So first of all, you asked about, you know, political influence, right? So a lot of these scientists who are making these decisions by grants don't actually work for the administration, don't work for the NIH, and so they're not tied to the politics of a
particular administration. This is kind of a volunteer.
Right, exactly. They're volunteering their time, yeah. So forth. The scientists who work at the NIH are not primarily political appointments, and so, you know, they span administrations. Dr. Collins, who is the head of the NIH, was appointed at the beginning of the Obama administration. Dr. Fauci's been there since the 80s.
Yeah.
So he's spanned many administrations. They're not...
They're scientists.
Right, their career is doing research, not being political animals. So there's not that much pressure. There are also other places besides the NIH that provide funding at the federal level. There's the National Science Foundation is another big one, and that has a somewhat broader focus. You know, the NIH is primarily focused on medical and biological research. Although there, you know, there's chemistry and biophysics, mm-hmm. and things that, you know, a lot of things that kind of are adjacent to that, including, you know, computational research and a lot of computer science work as well. But the applications are always focused on health and medicine. The National Science Foundation has a broader focus, and so there's more math and physics and computer science kinds of funding that comes out of there. There's also Department of Defense funding and NASA funding, and depending on what area you're in, there are different sources of funding. So that's the federal level. States obviously have some research budgets as well, though generally not as much. They might have, you know, some small things, but generally most of that funding is coming at the federal level. And then the biggest amount of money that is spent on research comes from private sources. So even though the NIH is the single biggest source, or the biggest single source, the largest chunk of the pie comes from private funding. And that includes corporate funding and nonprofits and private philanthropist individuals. So that's everything ranging from, you know, your Pfizers and your Mercks and so forth that are doing pharmaceutical research, to your Googles and your Amazons that are doing, you know, computer science and AI kinds of research, to, you know, cancer foundations and, you know, private charities and things like that, to, you know, the Gates Foundation. And, you know, some of these places, you know, the orders of magnitude difference in some of the budgets of, you know, an Amazon or a Facebook or a Google's research budget compared to some of these small private foundations that maybe were started by a family in memory of somebody who had a rare disease or a what have you. You know, and so you get the whole gamut, and depending on what you're studying, you know, there are different places that you can go to. And a lot of that private, you know, if for the on the corporate side, a lot of that money stays in-house, right? So they're not necessarily funding academic research. They're funding their own internal research or their own clinical trials or so forth. Some of those clinical trials, when it gets to that point, might be done in conjunction with the university or a medical system or things like that. But and it's different, you know, Amazon on the computer science side and artificial intelligence and self-driving cars and all that, there seems to be a closer relationship between private companies and universities. I haven't seen that as much in terms of like the pharmaceutical industry and biology departments. There's certainly sometimes there might be partnerships or a grant available to a lab that comes from a pharmaceutical company, but it's not like most of the research that's being done in a biology department at a university or at a hospital, you know, research hospital is being funded by pharmaceutical companies. A lot of it is also coming from the NIH. And so, yeah, and so that's good because now we have a wide range of all of these places, you know, when they offer grants, they have their priorities and their things that they're setting. And so that's getting back to your question of, what do we fund and who's deciding what we fund? These are, you know, some corporate interests, some scientists who are volunteering or, you know, leaders in their field to set agendas and so forth. And so we, you know, I think it's a good thing that we have that mix. I don't think we want just corporations funding these things, but there is a need for things to actually get to market and be available as products. And so there does need to be some amount of, of commercial investment, and academics institutions are not great at that.
And I think it's hard for the general population to be aware of how expensive some of this research can be. You know, we have some mutual friends who are, you know, bench scientists, and, you know, I've seen some of just kind of the general, you know, needs that they're needing to be fulfilled, like significant machines that, like, this isn't just like I need a new laptop, this is like, you know, I don't even know, because I'm an artist and right. not involved in, you know, test tube science.
Yeah, so there's a real range. So just to kind of finish one thought. Sorry. That's okay. So for an example of, like, we also want, you know, places to be funding basic science research and sort of science-led research. And to give one practical example, right now we're all thinking about, you know, testing for the coronavirus. And the test, and we've talked a little bit about this before, the test uses something called polymerase chain reaction or PCR. And we use that to amplify the RNA genome of the virus so that we can detect it, so we get enough copies of it that we can detect. And it involves a series of changes of temperature to go through different steps. And it used to be that you'd have to do those steps in different water baths. You have to move test tubes from one water bath to another. And you'd have to add new reagents to the test tube every time you moved it to a different temperature, because there would be a step that was too hot and would kill off everything. Well, then along came a bacteria that lives in hot springs that has a DNA polymerase that operates at really high temperatures, because the bacteria lives at really high temperatures. And so that is now the DNA polymerase that we use for PCR, which means you can load everything into the test tube at the beginning and just let it cycle through temperatures, which means now you can, it's more feasible to build a single machine that cycles through different temperatures, and you can do it much more quickly and more efficiently. And so the discovery of that, that hot springs bacterium,
they weren't easily setting out, right, they to, weren't setting to out find to, this particular thing to help with this other scientific problem. They were looking for something else.
Right. And so you absolutely could have taken the grant proposal for that project, whatever it was, or the papers that came out of that project, and you know, dice them up in a way that on a late night comedy show or you know, soundbite on a in a politician's speech, make it sound like we're throwing money away on
we're looking, you know, we're sending scientists to hot springs for vacation, like, you know, that kind of nonsense.
Right. And that's not to say that that never happens, and not to say that there shouldn't be any external accountability, that we should just always let the scientists decide what's right. But it's also the case that it can be difficult externally to know for sure what's going to be useful and what isn't. And it's also, you know, there's a little bit of a trick of just, you can take almost any, you know, science project and frame it in such a way that it sounds silly or sounds impractical or what have you.
Yeah, you know, if you look at that, you can look at that from a lot of, you know, different, you know, perspectives of, you know, how, you know, what ideas you think are going to be worth money. You know, who would have thought, you know, creating an online platform for people to post pictures of their food that they're eating, it would be a valuable, you know, money-making industry. And yet, here we are taking pictures of my lovely Mother's Day cake and posting it.
Exactly. So that's a little bit tricky to figure out in advance. So then what is that money going towards? So, you know, I've kind of been in different parts of it. You know, I did a postdoc in computer science. And in computer science, by and large, the biggest expense is people, right? Paying people salaries so that they can eat and have a place to live and so forth. In some aspects, especially when you get into more into robotics, there's more equipment to buy, or maybe you rent time on a supercomputer because you need to run something that's really computationally intensive, right? So it can range, but you know, I think it's more common in computer science to be able to do research with minimal equipment, and that the primary cost is people. In biomedical research, that isn't the case. It's more often the case that the big expense is equipment and supplies. It's not just the scientists that you have to feed and keep alive. It is the things that the scientists are studying, whether that's monkeys or mice or cells or bacteria. They're all living things. They all need their own kinds of food. They all need their own kinds of environments to live in. You know, they need a place, they need shelter, they need housing. And so now you're not just indirectly paying for the food and housing of your scientists. You're more directly paying for the food and housing and in case some cases medical care, right? For something like a monkey that lives longer, and so you're going to need to keep it healthy and well and have a veterinarian to watch over it, things like that. You know, so those costs can vary. So there are those kinds of costs. There are, you know, all the supplies for things like PCR and other kinds of lab tests and assays and experiments and things that get used up each time, and so you have to replenish those supplies.
Paying for dry ice and PVC pipe to trap mosquitoes.
Right. I did work with dry ice and had to go and buy 50 pounds of dry ice every morning. When I was an undergrad, you know, you had to go. Some of our work required liquid nitrogen, and so you'd go and get out, you know, a liter of liquid nitrogen or whatever, and they had a ledger, and you wrote down how much you use so that your lab could be charged for that amount, because that, you know, is a renewable thing that needs to be replenished. And then it's also sometimes there are big equipment costs as well. PCR machines are getting cheaper, but that used to be a big, you know, investment when those were new. You know, freezers to put things in, you know, a freezer that can keep things down to negative 80 degrees, you know,
this is different from like going to Walmart and getting a, you know, college freezer.
Right. All kinds of things. And again, that's not to say that, you know, the money is never mismanaged or whatever, but it there are significant costs to doing this. It's not just, you know, scientists getting rich. You know, even if some of the grant money seems really expensive, so you know, the numbers involved in these grants seems really high compared to, you know, the kinds of dollar amounts that we're used to using. And you were talking about figures in the millions and tens of millions for a lot of these bigger grants. You know, if you're only used to dealing with your household money, that might seem like a large sum, but that, you know, is going to paying multiple people.
Like it really is, you are cobbling together, you know, a couple thousand dollars here and there to kind of fund, you know, different people, different, you know, machines, different equipment. You know, it's really kind of, you know, patchworked together.
Right. The other thing to keep in mind about research funding is that, you know, a grant that goes through a university, there is a significant overhead. So you might get funded for, you know, $1 million, but what actually needs to flow into the university, or you might get $1 million for your actual science to buy all the things we just talked about and to pay the scientists and so forth. But what actually flows into the university might be close to $2 million. And that other, you know, and the number, the overhead figure varies from institution to institution. It can be closer to like a quarter or a half. It can be upwards of, you know, 3/4, you know, getting close to almost double is, you know, is overhead to pay for the administrative staff, to pay for things like copies and computers and things like that, and department facilities to pay to maintain the buildings, all those kinds of things that are a necessary part of just sort of keeping an organization going. You know, that money needs to come from somewhere too. And so those grants also include that spending as well. So it's not even all going directly into doing the science, it's going into support, logistically supporting the environment in which science can be done in a university setting.
And my understanding is some of those grants have like time frames on them. So it's not like, I keep thinking back to like a Jurassic Park we watched, you know, like a while ago.
Uh-huh.
But like whenever he, you know, blanking on his name, but when he shows up to, you know, their dig site and says, mm-hmm. I'm going to fund your research forever, like that doesn't really happen. You know, there's like a time limit. And so when that funding runs out, they're back to looking right. for more grants to fill in the gaps.
Right. Yeah. So you're talking about cycles that can be as short as a year. It can be, you know, a few years, but you're not talking generally more than like 5 years a single grant is going to extend out. Because there needs to be deliverables, right? And all these grants come with, once you are done, you have to show us that you did the thing that we paid for you to do and what were the results. And so there are deliverables. And there's some review of that and some accountability. And if you don't do well with those or don't provide, you know, that's going to hurt your ability to get future funding. Yeah, and so there's definitely a time limit. And so especially university scientists are often in a cycle of they're kind of always trying to figure out where the next grant is going to come from, because whatever they're currently on is only going to last a couple of years, and they probably had to get multiple grants together to be able to fund a reasonable sized lab and research team. And so chances are there's, you know, once you get into that kind of stage, there's always one grant that's coming up, which means you're always going to have to find something else to replace it, or you're always going to be somewhere in that cycle.
So then do you want to touch on, you know, I kind of feel like it helps to kind of break things down to like, you know, little bits that, you know, we can all walk away from. Like, so to me, I hear this and through other conversations that we've had, like big pharma, whatever you think that is, they're not getting rich off of the general research scientists that a lot of our universities and, you know, other, you know, organizations are trying to work on to kind of benefit our whole society.
So I think what it's fair to say is that there are lots of people doing biomedical research that are not getting rich off of it. There are certainly questions to be asked about certain drug prices and certain business practices in terms of pharmaceutical industry. You know, there's definitely a bias towards, for example, developing maintenance drugs that you have to take, you know, daily or weekly or whatever on an ongoing indefinite basis, because that is a regular source of revenue. Same reason why everybody wants, you know, all these companies are moving from selling you Blu-rays to selling you a monthly streaming subscription, mm-hmm. because then they know that they get consistent revenue month over month, as opposed to, you know, kind of hit or miss with a big release. Everybody wants that consistent income. Well, you know, the way that the pharmaceutical industry can get that consistent income is by developing medications that you have to take on an ongoing basis. And, you know, there are definitely legitimate questions to be asked about, is that always the best way to manage various conditions? Should we be investing more money into preventing some of these conditions so that you don't need to take medications? And so, you know, and it's absolutely the case that there's lots of money in pharmaceuticals, and that the margins on some of these things are quite high, and that and there you know there have even been examples of inappropriate behavior and inappropriate pricing and so forth. But that doesn't mean that doesn't mean that everything is inappropriate, and
we can't lump them all together.
Right.
It sounds like it's a lot more nuanced, and there are from the research that I've done and from the reading that I've done, I see that there are a lot more people who are in this and working for good as opposed to working to make themselves rich.
I think it's fair to say from my experience that people are getting into biology and biomedical science because they want to help people, and that from it's very unlikely that it's going to be a very lucrative career path. It may be more comfortable than some other options, and certainly it's not as strenuous kind of work as some other sort of physical jobs, but it's also not the case that it's just an unending gravy train, and it's it's gotten harder. There was a big boom in the 90s. The NIH budget increased significantly in the 90s, and that led to a boom in people going into the sciences, which has led to a boom in people looking for science funding, which means that we're actually now turning out a lot more science PhDs because the growth in the NIH budget didn't continue on that same trajectory. And so we're kind of overstocked on PhDs and the scientists relative to what NIH funding can provide, especially in the biomedical areas where NIH funding is most relevant. And it makes it tough to get started. So it's not...
It kind of creates this loop where they're not going to necessarily give you money unless you have a reputation for having good ideas, and you can't necessarily have the good ideas without the money to actually...
Yeah, there's a way of, there's a way of thinking about, grant funding that you kind of have to get your first grant based on research that is already done, and that you're actually using that grant to fund the next step of the process. It's not exactly like that, but there's a certain amount of, you kind of have to have a track record to start out with. And so that often means, for example, doing a postdoc with an established professor who already has established an ability to get grant funding and has a lab and a context to do funding in, and that the results of that grant, the results of the research that got funded by that grant that somebody else had gotten and invited you to participate in are what you can use to then get your next own grant for yourself, which is why a lot of people's career trajectory, it's based on, in these biomedical fields where postdocs are more common, that what you do for your postdoc kind of impacts what you do for your career as a scientist on your own, at least the early stages of it, more so than your doctoral thesis. You might think that, your doctoral thesis is kind of the first step in whatever your career is, but it may very well be the case that your doctoral thesis is very different from what you can get a postdoc position in. And so it's actually that postdoc that impacts what you wind up doing further on in your career, because that's how you can get that first grant on your own, which and then enables you to get that second grant and so forth. And so that kind of puts you on a particular trajectory.
And that's where, that also seems like that's where, because a lot of this is, the young scientists are coming out of universities, having, the private corporations and foundations also kind of filling in with some of that funding can really help, bring more attention to a wider range of candidates who have, valuable research to contribute.
I mean, we're definitely seeing that more scientists are having to go into non-academic career tracks in order to make a living. Some of them outside of science, some of them in the private sector, and some of them in an academic setting, but having to get funding through other sources because the federal funding isn't going to supply everybody to do the work. And again, we can talk about, we've got a surplus of scientists and we should have directed them into other career paths or whatever. But the reality is this is where we are right now, and we have to figure out how to best use their training and their expertise in a way that is beneficial to everybody, especially in the cases where you know, we've all, through federal tax money, helped pay for them to get that training in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you also had some questions. You know, we've talked now a lot about where the money comes from and the pre-experimenting work. We're also talking about, you know, you got to show results when you're done.
Yeah.
And you had some questions about that in the publishing process as well.
Yes. You know, there's been a lot of a chatter of, I keep forgetting what that term is. I know that there are peer-reviewed studies. There's the peer review process, but then there's also this like preprint. Yes. So, you know, let's hear, like, have a little bit of a beginner's course on, you do the science, you get your funding, you do the science, and now you have to write it all up and share it with the world.
Right. So you have results and you want to share. So you're primarily sharing it with your fellow scientists, right? So the best way to think about the scientific literature is that it is correspondence and a conversation between scientists to update each other on what they found and what their next ideas are and what they think, you know, the broader implications are of their particular study.
So I think it's really, really clear to kind of focus in on, you know, this is a very collaborative, you know, across the world, basically, because you have scientists from all over the world that are, you know, they're all looking at research and, you know, I guess evaluating it or...
Yeah, so people from all over the world are scientists from all over the world are reading the literature and evaluating different things. And with the availability of online journals, it makes it easier. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to read a journal paper, you had to find a physical print copy of it, which generally meant going to a university library because that was the only places that people, you know, were paying to subscribe to these journals and archiving them, and they'd have to archive them, you know, indefinitely. They'd have, you know, 50, 60 years worth of journals in some cases, either, you know, the paper bound sitting on a shelf or, you know, scanned into something like a microfilm or whatever. And, you know, and you had to go and find a physical copy of it in some form or another. And that meant that you were kind of limited to what was locally around and what your university happened to subscribe to and what was written in a language you could read. You know, there's some, if you go into the history of science, there's some interesting, you know, parallel discoveries of folks in, you know, America and European countries where science was published in English, and Russian countries, Russian scientists, where the literature was published in Russian, finding the same things and not really knowing about it because nobody, you know, the English-speaking folks couldn't read the Russian papers and the Russian-speaking folks couldn't read the English papers. More and more people are, you know, conducting their science in English, and so that makes things easier to access. More and more science is published online, and so you might still need a subscription, but it's easier to get access to, you know, more subscriptions. The university, while there's still financial considerations, there's no longer that physical constraint of we need to find a place to put all these, you know, back issues. So now I can subscribe to more journals and have access to their entire back catalog, and not just what I happen to have kept. And so, yeah, we're seeing more research being able to review things more and more. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, the audience, you know, it's not that you're not supposed to read these papers or that you shouldn't feel like you're allowed to or anything like that, but just to keep in mind that, you know, for a long time it was really only other scientists that were generally reading these papers, and so the audience is still kind of expected to be other scientists.
Well, and there is a difference in a scientific, how a scientific paper is written as opposed to how any other essay might be written. You know, just because, you know, there are lots of people writing lots of essays on different things, and pretty much, you know, if you're reading that language, you can sit down and understand it. But it's different with scientific reports, I'm guessing.
I mean, it's
you, it you is still it understand, but like there's different yeah. parts that are.
Yeah, there's a lot of technical language that may even be the same words, but it means something more precise or more technical in a scientific setting than in a broader setting. You know, a common example of that is a theory, right? So in science, we talk about theories. That's actually a framework for a number of different hypotheses that has been, you know, well tested and well understood. It's sort of a broad way of thinking about a particular field that has been scrutinized and stood the test of time. Whereas in casual usage, a theory is more like an idea that I have that I don't know whether it's real or not. And so, you know, there's lots of words like that. And even in different scientific disciplines, there might be the same words that are used, but they mean different things in different subdisciplines.
You were talking about discharge this week and how, depending on the people talking about it, it can be very different things.
Yeah. So I was reading, you know, I deal with healthcare text data at work. And sometimes it's real short little bits of text, and it can be really hard to figure out because there's not enough context to figure out what people mean. And there was a reference to discharge, and it was unclear whether that meant that the patient could go home or that something was leaking. And in the medical context, it can mean both.
And when you're looking at that and not necessarily knowing what you're looking at, you can come to very different conclusions and can, you know, lead to a misunderstanding.
Yeah. So if things are unclear like that, or if, you know, words are being used in a way that is different from intended, or things are seem obscure, it's not necessarily that the scientists are trying to keep that from you, just that they weren't thinking about you when they were writing it. They were thinking about the 10 other people that do work in that specific field that they probably already know personally, and that's who they expect to read the paper most likely. So these journal articles, you know, so you write up your research. And ideally, you know, the standard or the ideal is certainly that it should be clear and accessible and understandable by more than just those 10 other people in that specific discipline. But, you know, we're all human and we're all limited. We don't know what other people do and don't know. And so we don't always reach that ideal. And so you write up your results, you submit them to a journal, and then a journal will have other scientists in that field in some capacity that have already volunteered to contribute to the journal in that way. And they'll get a copy of the paper and they'll review it. And that's what the peer review process is. And it's generally anonymous. And it's generally unpaid, right? So this is just people doing this as part of their career service to the field of science. And, you know, they're providing their input on first of all, is it just clear and understandable what was done? And then were the appropriate tests done? Were the appropriate controls used? Was the appropriate statistical analysis applied?
And this is where it's important for people who are familiar with what is going on to be the ones, you know, looking at it and evaluating. Like, because having, you know, while a scientist in another field might have ideas, they won't necessarily understand the whole process, and so they can miss.
Yeah, so you don't just kind of randomly pick, you know, a scientist to peer review something. You pick somebody who is familiar enough with the literature in that field to know where this fits in the conversation. Because it's essentially, you know, every science paper is, you know, if you just pick up a science paper and read it, a journal publication and read it, it's, you're joining a conversation in midstream. And so you want somebody who has a little bit, who has done some of the work to be able to get caught up on that context. It's kind of like, I mean, one way to think about it is it's like picking up, you know, issue 512 of Uncanny X-Men, right? You can maybe kind of figure out what's going on to some extent, but there's going to, you know, there's all kinds of continuity and context and history that somebody who has been reading X-Men comics for 20 years will understand better and more immediately without having to look things up than you will for your first time. That doesn't mean everybody has to start with issue number one. There are lots of resources that you can use to get
it means caught you should up. Talk to somebody who knows comics before you just pick up a comic book. I've learned.
that's not the point. The point is, you know, just again, you remember that you're joining a conversation in midstream, and so, you know, you might have to listen a little bit before you get the gist of it to be able to really, you know, contribute to that conversation. So there'll be review comments, and they'll either just, you know, say this just isn't good enough to be published at all, or they'll say it needs to be revised in this way, both for clarity and possibly, you know, to do some more science, right? So it might be that you have to rewrite parts, but it might also be that you have to go back to the lab and run a new experiment or run some new statistical analysis or something like that to satisfy the reviewers that you've explored all the other possible interpretations of what's going on and ruled out possible sources of contamination or confusion or things like that. And so then it'll get published. And that process can take weeks or months or even, you know, close to a year, just because, you know, these are working scientists who are doing other things with their time. They're not professional reviewers. And so they might, you know, wait to get a few of them piled up. And then this, okay, today I'm just going to do my, you know, journal peer review steps or whatever the case might be. It can take some time. And then you got to go back and make the revisions, which if it means doing more experiments can take some time. And then you got to submit it back and make sure that you've satisfied the requirements. So all that, you know, takes a while, and then it actually has to come out in print, which means the journal has to kind of slot it into its publishing schedule. They're printing a physical, they're still, even though most of it is going online, they are still by and large printing physical objects that have a fixed number of pages and need to come out in a certain time, which means they need to go to the printers, you know, 2 weeks before, whatever, you know, whatever that sequence of events is. So there's a schedule to that as well. And so after all the steps have been made and everybody's satisfied that it can be published, it might still be a couple months before it actually appears in print. Although often nowadays it'll be available online as a peer-reviewed publication with a specific, you know, it's going to be in the July issue, and but you can download it and read it now. But if you, you know, if you don't want to wait for the print copy. But now, but because that's a slow process, something that we're seeing a lot of, and going back to your question from a while ago, is the preprint. And that is kind of what it sounds like. Before it's going to be printed in a journal, before it's gone through that whole peer review process, sharing things with your scientific colleagues to just kind of let them know, hey, this is something I have found. I think it's worth knowing about before a year from now when it's going to potentially come out in a printed journal. I want you to see it now so that you can make your own assessments of it. And so, you know, that's an extension of personal communication and emails, and before that, telephone conversations and in-person conversations at conferences that has been going on for a long time in science, right? Scientists have always shared their results before publication with some other people that they trust or are collaborating with or they know are working on similar things so that they can get a sense of what's going on. It's always, you know, it's an ongoing conversation that happens in different ways, and the journal publication is just one part of that process. But with the advent of computer technology and computer storage and the internet, it became more prevalent to actually have centralized places for people to put these things so that you might not know everybody who would be interested in your latest result. And so you just kind of put it up on a server that other people can access. And then, you know, whoever wants to, and again, you don't even have to be a scientist to read this. And because they're not journal publications yet, such that a journal is concerned about, you know, the revenue of selling that as a part of a subscription to an ongoing journal, they're often, you know, not behind a paywall. You know, these preprints are generally freely available to everybody. And so more people can pay attention to them. And so, you know, in a situation like is going on right now with the coronavirus, everybody wants to know what they can know as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And so more and more people are looking at those preprints than have ever done that before, and may not even always be appreciating the difference between a preprint and a peer-reviewed publication. You know, a lot of those preprints are going to go through revisions, and, you know, that may be substantial or that may be minor in terms of the conclusions of the paper and the reliability of the results. But, you know, there is that possibility that it may not get published at all, may not get accepted at all, or there's a possibility that it will need some significant revision. So those should always be read with a little bit more skepticism, a little bit more eye on this hasn't been vetted as thoroughly as something that gets
published. This is even like, you know, science journalists, you know, can be reading these things and, you know, wanting to share and add to the overall conversation. So, you know, so there's the motive for good. Like, this is not being done maliciously. This is not trying to, you know, necessarily, you know,
nobody's trying to circumvent the
yeah, the they're system. Not trying to pull one over on, you know, and get people to believe things that aren't necessary. This is a lot of learning that is going on and trying to get, you know, there's a lot of anxiety around not knowing, and so trying to, you know, put out as much knowledge as possible But that, you know, part of this process is learning, you know, what's going to work and what isn't.
Right. So there's a desire to share information as quickly as possible. There, you know, I would say that the overall effect of the preprint process that has kind of bloomed, or the preprint ecosystem that has bloomed with the advent of the internet, is more scrutiny and more review of these papers, because more people are looking at them before they get to the publication step. More scientists and more non-scientists. But it does mean that there's more things circulating out there that may or may not be as fully vetted results as used to be the case. And they're just more widely known about. And so you have to balance that. You have to pay attention to where these things are coming from, you know, what kind of scrutiny it's already been through. And that doesn't mean that, you know, every peer-reviewed paper is perfect either. You know, there are some things that come up after the publication process. But, you know, as with anything, the more review, the more people look at it, the more accountability and the more transparency, the more fine things get. And you weed out the things that aren't as helpful and aren't as accurate and aren't as clearly stated. Overall, again, I think having these preprints helps contribute to that process positively, but it's still a relatively new phenomenon. And I think with this coronavirus, there's a lot more attention being paid to things that are being shared as preprints that I think we need to kind of catch up a little bit in our understanding of. This isn't the same as what I read in a textbook that's, you know, by the time something gets in a textbook, generally speaking, it's, you know, been through a number of different studies and, you know, confirmed from multiple different angles. Or the time something gets to a shelf in terms of a product that you can buy, you know, or a drug that you can be prescribed or what have you, that's been through more rounds of those, you know, those clinical trials and different kinds of review and so forth. So that's a little bit more reliable than, you know, things in those very early stages, which is what you can sometimes be seeing in the preprint servers.
So it's a lot.
Yeah. There's a lot that goes into how science is done. And, yeah. You know, there's definitely places where it can be improved and definitely places where, you know, individual circumstances where it has, you know, let us down. But, you know, the issue is sort of what else, you know, the goals and the values are on transparency, accountability, review, and
replication,
yeah, and all, like, you know, all those values I think are good things. And so I'm not really sure at a macro scale what we would replace it with.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's been set up so that there are a lot of checks and balances, you know, within the whole, I guess, you know, scientific community, you know, to try and make sure that, you know, the best ideas are getting.
That's, you know, that's certainly the goal.
I guess best ideas is not necessarily the right way to say it, but, you know, they're trying to really, you know, learn and understand and make progress.
Yeah, the majority of scientists want the reputation of science to be solid, because that's why they have a career in science, right? Is that, you know, it has a good reputation for delivering reliable results because of these processes, because it isn't just anything goes. You do have to test things and prove them and get them reviewed by other folks who will scrutinize it and want to kind of pick holes in it. And, you know, often scientists themselves will be the biggest critics of their own work because they know it most clearly and because they don't want to have their name associated with something that down the line turns out to be not true or unreliable or unhelpful to this broader conversation. And so, you know, again, it's not that it is also a human endeavor. And humans are imperfect in ways both intentional and unintentional. And so, you know, continued scrutiny and accountability is appropriate, but it's also part of the process. Like, you're not saying anything new by saying that we need to keep scientists accountable and review their work, because that's already built into things at every step of the way. You know, you're from before you start the work, your grant has to be approved by somebody, which means that other scientists have to look at it and decide that you're your approach makes sense and that you're doing something that contributes to what the overall community needs. And, you know, all the way up through when it's time to actually share those results, people making sure that this is worth adding to the conversation.
And I think the more likely personalities that you find that go into the scientists, like thinking of Dr. Fauci and thinking of, I'm assuming Francis Collins is also a doctor.
Yeah, he's
yeah. I don't know if it's medical doctor or PhD, but he's got to be for being up there. But like, these are not the kinds of men who are standing up and saying, this is exactly what it is. They're constantly saying, you know, we're learning more. We're getting, you know, we're breaking it down and into further understanding, I guess, is I think what we tend to see with a lot of scientists. Or maybe I'm just biased because only the ones that I know are like that.
I think that there is, again, I think there's a goal in the system to instill a certain level of humility, of question your own results, be your own harshest critic. And so there's some amount of, if that's not how you're wired, you're not going to make it through the process. Again, with exceptions and so forth. And so whether that's a personality thing or whether that's a skill that's developed, you know, that's a question for psychologists and cognitive researchers and so forth that is a little bit out of my area of expertise. But I do think that one way or the other, the process of becoming a scientist does tend to foster that sort of measured or kind of qualified approach to things that we may not be 100% certain about everything. So we're going to try to be clear about what the evidence for things is, why we think things are a certain way, how it could possibly, you know, what some of the alternatives are, what we're pretty sure we've ruled out, which alternatives are pretty sure we've ruled out, and what we still need to know. You know, every science paper, you know, ends with, here's what we still don't know now that we've done this work. Here's new questions that it brought up, or questions that it leaves unresolved that we already had. And so, you know, there's always some amount of recognition that there is remaining uncertainty, remaining questions, remaining doubt. Maybe not about that particular topic. Like, we may have answered a question with this paper. Hopefully there's something that we've resolved with this paper. Otherwise, it's unlikely they publish, but there's still yet another thing to explore after that point. And so, you know, that really kind of keeps you in check, right? Because you're never reaching that point where I've solved it all. I've finished science. I can go home now and do something else, right? There's always more to uncover. There's always more that you can, realizing that you don't know by doing the research. It's just as much a process of revealing what we don't know as it is adding to what we do know. And so, yeah, I think that does encourage a particular kind of mindset in scientists one way or the other.
I think that's where I kind of gravitate a little more into the sciences, just because that's just a very similar approach that I have with art. It's always, okay, well, how can I make this better next time? Like, you know, not necessarily asking questions and the same sense, but that kind of drive to, you know, learn more, improve, make it better.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. We've talked a lot.
Yeah, the downside of this is that when you get a scientist talking, you get a lot of qualifications and side tangents and not as many maybe clear and straightforward answers as you might want.
But I think it was good. I think, you know, these are a lot of, you know, questions that we don't necessarily, you know, get to find the answers to without actually, you know, knowing people in that science community. And it's a little bit different from, you know, knowing doctors and nurses. It's that research scientist is in a little bit of a different area than, you know, the medical, you know, not saying there's one's better than the other, just
they're different styles of training,
yeah,
to become a physician than to become a research, yeah, scientist. Some people do both. And, you know, some people get the training of a physician, but for whatever reason, also have some of the skills and mindset of a research scientist, and vice versa. But But yeah, there definitely are differences in how they're trained. And so the end result of the kind of people that you are is different as well.
But I'm thinking, you know, it's easy, you know, it's pretty common to find somebody who is in the medical field, but not necessarily always finding.
Right. Hopefully we all are seeing physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners and so forth on some regular basis, but not everybody has to interact with a professional scientist.
But this is why we have our friendly neighborhood biologist. So if you need to know a scientist, come meet Andy.
Sure.
maybe not come meet Andy, but...
email me at biobreakpod@gmail.com.
So I think we're wrapping up.
Yeah. Or find us on Twitter at biobreakpod on Twitter.
Or Facebook.
Yep. Search for BioBreak on Facebook. And send us our questions and feedback and anything you would like us to tackle on future episodes. And until then, keep washing your hands.
And don't touch your face.